In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. Lucy, we're having a lovely week in the midst of all these storms. We have a storm of immense popularity surrounding us. Our numbers at the podcast are doing very well. We're getting lots and lots of new listeners all around the world. We're so grateful to have you. And I'm not very good at doing these sort of self-congratulatory things. Not because I don't like them and I'm a modest person.
We do like them.
I really like them. Oh, I love them. I just think I might sound a bit cheesy. So will you take over, Lucy, with some of this cheese?
Just to say that we're just so delighted that anyone at all is listening, frankly. Please do keep listening because we love it. And get in touch with us. Talk to us about things. We did get one letter, very nice letter, a week or so ago, from somebody who's going to, lives in the States, I think. I won't give names, we don't give out names, but lives in the States and going to visit London and asking if we could recommend a good walking tour of the homes and neighbourhoods of writers who've lived in London because they couldn't find one. And I'm sorry that we haven't replied to you directly. We're replying now. Hello. But also I couldn't really think of one.
And I don't live in London. Look, I'm just saying. I could maybe recommend somebody in Dublin if you get to Ireland, and I'd be very delighted to.
That would be brilliant as well, wouldn't it? But let's put it as a call out. So if any of our listeners do know of any brilliant guides, I suppose literary guides to London.
Yes, what our correspondent is looking for is someone who's really got a good knowledge of history and literature. I.e. not a sort of, you know, no shade on them, but not a sort of just a kind of blue plaque tour. Somebody who's got a real feeling for some of the stories. And I feel sure that one of or more of our wonderful listeners will know. So please get in touch. I think our listener is coming relatively soon, beginning of next month. So if you're moved to share your crack recommendations with us, please do.
And in fact, we should give an email address. You could write to letters@the-tls.co.uk, the market for the podcast, and that will get to us. And Alex, also, I have to say I'm a little bit proud of myself this week because I've done some rereading based on something you said last week.
Oh, go tell.
Because we were talking about the kind of the many, many storms which seem to be constantly whipping around everywhere. And you said, I'm here on Cold Comfort Farm. And I thought, oh, I haven't read that for a while. So I had the great pleasure of rereading Cold Comfort Farm.
It's never the wrong thing to do, is it?
It's not, is it? It's really not. It was delightful.
I might
have
to do it myself.
Aged
now.
So well. There's a couple of kind of dodgy bits, but basically it's just aged so well and it's so funny. And I like to think that you live on Cold Comfort Farm. Though is it before or after is what I wonder.
Well.
Should we leave that to the listener's imagination?
Yeah, quite. Right, moving swiftly on. This week, Lamorna Ashe gets caught up in the classroom power struggles of the latest Mean Girls reboot. And Professor Eric Naiman on the challenges of marking student essays in the age of ChatGPT.
But first, this week, we're going to make Fetch happen. And if you're wondering what on earth I'm on about, let me explain that it's a phrase from Mean Girls, the sharp, funny and highly influential high school comedy from 2004, written by Tina Fey. It has now been rebooted, updated and, just for good measure, turned into a musical. So we asked Lamorna Ash to go along and report back for us, and we're very happy that she can join us now. Lamorna, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So in your piece, you tell us about some absolutely brilliant and slightly alarming Mean Girls related activity in your own school. Before we get to that, could you perhaps put that in context for our listeners who don't know the film, one of which is Alex, it turns out. She's never seen Mean Girls.
Yes, me. So I want to know what make fetch means. I need to know
make
that.
Fetch happen.
So, it's the three words.
Yeah, okay. You have to make fetch happen, except it's not one of the cool girls that says it, except she is in a... It's very complicated. Lamorna...
Yeah, let me take you through fetch.
Let's take this as a sort of microcosm to the whole thing.
I wish someone had told me at 14 that this would one day become a useful thing to have that knowledge, that I'd be on the TLS able to explain it.
That's not about useful.
So... The Plastics are a group of mean girls who are at this school in Illinois, North Shore High, and they are all trying to accrue cultural capital in some way or another, in some way to make themselves more interesting or basically to stay relevant and therefore to have the queen mean girl, Regina George, to continue liking them. So one of them is trying to make fetch happen, the term fetch in this case meaning that's cool. So she keeps trying to make fetch happen. In the 2024 adaptation of it, the musical, that character, Gretchen Wiener, she again says fetch. And then when someone says, you're never going to make fetch happen, where does that even come from? She goes, oh, some old TV film or something like Juno, which is again one of those, because that was another classic of my generation, teenage coming of age films.
Is Juno like a thing from the past now?
I think it must be.
Oh, even I'm afraid it is.
It's just impossible.
Okay. I rewatched that as well over Christmas with my friends, and something, and I think this, it's what's so interesting about watching those films when you're 13, 14, totally influenced by the young people in it, but also you have complete blinkers on where you're only noticing the young people. And when we rewatched Juno, and I've had this experience with so many films, we suddenly realize that the adults in the film are having the most terrible time trying to adopt this baby. And that it's a really painful, agonizing film about this couple breaking down. But I just don't even think I had any idea that that was happening the first time I saw it.
Ah, you see. Now, isn't her the mum in Juno, or is she the stepmom? Is she her stepmom? She's CJ from The West Wing. Anyway, yes, am I right? So, of course, I watched it, and I only watched it. Might as well have been called CJ from The West Wing. Alison Janney, for me, you see. Here you go. You're right. We watch through our own lenses, don't we? Okay.
At the risk of sounding very boring and old school, I think the same thing. Well, the same thing happens with a lot of things, actually. And the same thing happened for me. I mean, it has also, of course, happened with films, but it happened for me with Middlemarch. The second time I read Middlemarch, the first time you just don't care about anything but what Dorothea is going to do. And then the second time you see everybody else having an awful time and wonder how they're going to get out of it and all of that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. And by the time you're really well into middle age, you're very, very sorry for Casaubon, aren't you? This poor
the key
guy.
To all
there
mythology.
He is.
We're all trying to make it, grafting away,
exactly. Not being sort of loved, and he's all, and then, you know, that's it. Doesn't work out for him. Anyway, Lamorna, sorry. Mean Girls, make fetch happen.
Yeah, so there are the mean girls, and then Katie comes along, doesn't she?
Katie comes along in the initial Mean Girls. She comes vaguely from Africa. And in the new adaptation, she comes from Kenya because, at least on a cosmetic level, there's some.
We've learned that there are countries. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So Katie, it was homeschooled. There's also a joke from Tina Fey, who is still the teacher, having been the teacher 20 years ago in the original Mean Girls, that when we find out that Katie was homeschooled, she goes, oh, great. So that's less money for me, and my union is against people like you. So there's like a few updated jokes. But Katie turns up. She has no experience of so-called girl world, but her parents are zoologists, and she has this understanding of the hierarchies within animals on the plains of Africa, and she is able to transfer this over to start to get a sense of girl world and which ones are the key predators, and how all of them are living in relation to one another. And there's this incredible scene in the original where they're all at the mall, because the action in a very good teen way is either in school or at the mall or in their bedrooms on the phone to one another. Mm. And suddenly you get this mystical, magical moment where all of them are actually acting like animals, which, to be honest, is not dissimilar to how they're acting when they are girls as well.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
The girls will start grooming each other and the boys start sort of panting and hooting and showing off and throwing themselves about. And
we're sounding a bit Lars von Trier now.
No, it's not really.
Okay. All right. Is that a bit hopeful of me? Okay.
So Katie comes along and she sort of, for various reasons, ingratiates herself with the plastics, who are these three, and the queen bee of whom is the aptly named Regina George. And then it's about the various kind of pitfalls and problems that she has along the way. So Lamorna, tell us what you say in your piece about what happened at your own school, which just, I was just absolutely amazed by it, which really does show how influential the film was.
Yeah, so at my school, we watched it every term in maths class. On the last day of term, we'd be shown Mean Girls. And that the obvious reason for that, if there's any obvious reason for it, is that there is a whole subplot about maths, that Katie is amazing at maths and she is part of Mathletes. But also I think that was a teacher who was one of those teachers who was obsessed with our gossip, which is so unpalatable as a kid. He'd ask us, what's the gossip, girls? And then in our year, in year nine, which in my head, having worked with teenagers quite a lot, is the hardest year, because it really is the point at which they suddenly become so self-conscious and these cruelties start to happen. And a group rose to the top of our school. They were called the Buff Eight, the eight of them, self-titled.
The Buff Eight.
Imagine calling yourself the Buff Eight. I mean, riding for a fall, I would say.
Oh, I know, completely. I actually, the head of the buffet, who is now my friend, and it's funny now, I said that I was going to put this in the piece, and she still is horrified and humiliated by it. I'm like, please don't name me, which
no,
of
we
course
won't,
I
we
won't.
Name anyway, yeah, kudos to her, at least, for the wonderful name.
Yeah, exactly. And they had a burn book. So a crucial plot element of Mean Girls is the burn book, which the girls use as some kind of therapeutic offloading, the Mean Girls, where they write down nasty things about other girls in their year. So that someone is a grotsky little biatch is my favourite one. And someone is a fat virgin and that kind of thing. And because everyone had watched Mean Girls at my school, this group then created a burn book, left it very unsubtly lying around, because the whole point, if you're going to make a burn book, it has to be read. That's sort of, you know, the way that the plot must go. And I was thinking about, when I was watching the adaptation of it, to what extent Mean Girls made us meaner, or, you know, offered us the weaponry with which to carry out this cruelty. But I think ultimately we would have found any form for that we could have used any other high school film. All of them show this, or we would have just naturally had it in ourselves to.
But this was just the sort of vector.
Exactly.
Mean Girls, it was just that attack. Form that it took. Something I wanted to ask you about is, you know, as a coming to this as an outsider, is how much are the phrases that people recognize from it, which I recognize the phrases, but I don't associate them with Mean Girls. Did it create them, or was it picking up on the language of the time?
Oh, it's a mixture. Quite a lot of it is picking up on the language of the time. And I've since listened to the music of the new one quite a lot, and it really is noticing the shift in the kind of like jargon that teenagers use. But some of it, there's these particular phrases that spring from that, that people say, or people at my age said all the time. Like, I'm trying to think of a good example. Oh, there's one line where they do these apologies to one another, and one of them says, I don't hate you because you're fat because I hate you. And horrible, brilliant lines like that.
Yes, no, it's pretty, what's the word? That's why I was saying sharp. It's not quite brutal, but it's not far off, is it? I mean, it's funny and it's satire, but it's tough, some of it.
Totally.
I don't want to come across all cancel culture. I didn't think you were allowed to say things like that anymore.
Well, they don't. Yeah, the lines have changed in that way.
I see.
But actually, Tina Fey said something really interesting about that, that what she thinks is that a character like Regina George just knows, they're wily teenagers, knows that the language has changed, and therefore the ways in which you can be cruel have shifted. So In fact, I texted my school friends. I was like, do you think kids have got less mean than our age? And they were like, no way. It's just that they have to be sneakier. Things have moved online. There's more anonymity with it. What you can bully someone about has altered. When I was researching a bit about for the piece, I was looking into the source that Tina Fey used. And there's this incredible, like 8,000 word New York Times piece about the co-writer, Rosalind Wiseman, who in the early noughties would go around schools and she would try to help teenage girls treat each other less badly. And so she would make them all stand and read apologies to one another and they would all cry.
So that does happen in the film.
Exactly. And there's other things like in this piece, they talk about the horror of three-way calls, which was a particular attack mode at the time and is used as a kind of almost like Shakespearean gulling scene within the film where three people are on a call, but one girl doesn't know that the third girl is on the call and is then fed a line of, you know, don't you think that she's a bit of a mean person? And when she says, yes, I do, then the other one goes, oh, can't believe you said that because she's been on the line the whole time.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then in the piece as well, what's so interesting is it's by Margaret Talbot and it's so in depth. She then interviews quite a lot of the girls who go through this process of trying to treat each other better. And she says, how effective do you think the methods that Wiseman uses are? And the kids say, oh, it's a bit corny. Like we're more likely to sort it out ourselves by bullying one another further. But it was very useful to learn their different popularity terms. So again, it just becomes another thing they can incorporate.
Oh, gosh. Alex, this makes it sound awful, but we have to say this is a comedy. This is a satire.
It just sounds frightening. I'm terrified.
It's all heightened with the colour turned up and as Lamorna says, there's these wonderful scenes where they turn into sort of pack animals and things. But it is supposed to be funny. It is also tough. The thing about it is that the mean girls in it, the Plastics, two of them aren't really very mean at all anyway, but they're really the villains of the piece, not the heroines, but they're sort of irresistible. The main character, Katie, turns into one, more or less. That's why it's funny that they're the ones, that in your school, they're the ones that they copied. I mean, they're not supposed to be, they're not the admirable figures. They're absolutely not. And yet, they're the ones that everybody wants to be around. You know, it's the thing about the devil having all the best tunes, isn't it?
Oh, completely. Yeah, they're irresistible in that way. But I think that sense of it sounding really cruel, I think, and you know, so many contemporary high school films do this, like Eighth Grade, where kids get bullied, and that does the opposite and really looks at the kids who have a hard time at school and are trying to make it. But I was thinking about this of it happens and it's cruel and it definitely has after effects, but the other side of this is that way that you're learning so much about social cues and each time you hurt someone at that age and then you realize the repercussions are awful. And I do think it teaches you ways to be kinder to one another, and that the film ends with them all doing, basically all realizing that at the end of the year, they cannot go on like this. They do this trust exercise where they each have to apologize to one another. They notice how much they've hurt one another and how they're all actors within this system. And they come out the other side. And I think I have that with my school friends where it was awful and there's days you don't want to go to school and yet our relationships are so strong because I think you're trying out everything, you're learning so much about how not to behave and it's so different from boys in that way who are like possibly more physical but are not having those deep relationships where yes, gossip's currency, but also you are talking about everything that's happening in your lives with one another.
So to get back to the film, what does this reboot do then that's different from the original? What's 20 years done for it? What has it changed much?
I suppose they've got social media and WhatsApp and things for a start.
Exactly that. So it opens in like iPhone aspect ratio with, I think they're live on TikTok. I don't have TikTok. It could be Instagram Live, but there's definitely elements where things spread faster through the internet. There's a line in one of the songs about that filter you use, meaning Instagram filters. That's just how I look, which I think is really good. And then in terms of the plot, it's almost exactly the same. There's the same lines from the original. The characters have the same names. The thing that's different is that it's a musical and it's based on the Broadway musical. And that means that the plot is condensed quite a lot because the music takes up a lot of time. And that's basically it. Otherwise, honestly, the arc is identical to the original.
Gosh, is there something, though, that's... Well, obviously, there's something in society
that's different about the way we think about girls and what a girl's identity versus a boy's identity. And obviously the fluidity of gender is, that must be reflected somehow, even if not overtly, in any kind of updating of a sort of boys, girls in juvenilia kind of setting.
Well, I think this is where the film fails, because I don't think it does that sufficiently. And what I would say is that Mean Girls, in a way, was groundbreaking and ahead of its time, because boys are nothing in the original film.
It passes the Bechdel test with flying colours.
Yeah, it really does. They're just passive. They're another object to be used within the girls' wars. And so I think that's one of the reasons why we loved Mean Girls when we were young. But I think with this update, again, it strikes me as lazy. It strikes me as Paramount just making more money off a good thing, that they don't think, how's it shifted? There's nothing really playing with the fluidity of gender at all. There's one character who, in the original, she was kind of a queer icon, Janice. She was a goth. And in the new version, she's ever so slightly more out, but still in this way that it doesn't get to be spoken about. It really doesn't push like that at all. The girls still have the same expectations about, it's still very feminine coded clothing. I couldn't really see any sense of trying to really think about what's different for young people now.
That is surprising.
And is Janice really called Janice Ian?
Yeah.
That is a brilliant.
Isn't that wonderful? She's like the embodiment. Reference. The original Janice is like almost like the embodiment of the song at 17, except she is actually very pretty, of course, because everyone's very pretty. So she's just a bit of a goth and she's very pretty. But did you think that's right, Lamona? She's sort of embodying the antithesis of the popular girls, the queen bees, all that sort of thing.
Exactly that, because she had been a queen bee before, but she got burned badly by Regina. And she is this only character who is, wearing big baggy shirts and has her huge black sort of ringed eye makeup. And she doesn't play the game at all. She's completely anti the game. And yet in this version, she seems much more part of it. Even though she has the same lines, it's like they weren't brave enough to make her difficult and bold and angry as she was in the original.
I was thinking about, you say that it's kind of, it's all stuck in a kind of Groundhog Day because it's always repeating itself. I was thinking about the earlier wave of high school films like 10 Things I Hate About You and the Mighty Clueless. And of course, those are based on Shakespeare and Jane Austen. So there's a lot to compete with. But part of the point of those is that you change, don't you? And you're right, Lamona, there is a scene at the end. There's the sort of forgiveness scene, and then there's a scene at the prom where people treat each other better. But the key thing that you highlight is that then in the 2004 film, they turn around and they look, and they can see the next three plastics, the next three mean girls walking up the road, clearly about to start dominating the school. It really is sort of in a circle, isn't it?
Yeah, this iterative loop of it. And I suppose that's why, in a way, I mean, I think having watched, I love 10 Things I Hate About You at the time, and rewatching that, there's parts of it where, because it's, Taming of the Shrew, that don't work so well anymore. And yet there's something about that sense of kids are always going to have gone through school. They're always going to have their first kisses. They're always going to suddenly have this sense of what their body is in relation to other people, that it does mean that when high school films are done well, they probably will last for an incredibly long time and keep speaking anew to people.
But sadly, you think so Alex hasn't seen either of them. Which one do you think she should see, if either of them?
There's also Mean Girls 2, which I'm told is a very terrible sequel. So I was not that one. I'd say I'd just go to the original. It truly is a great film. There's incredible lines. It's very, very funny. I would also read that piece from 2002, because it even tells you about this character who Regina George is based on, this kid who is absolutely the queen bee. And then you get the sense from her mum of her obsession with rules and regulations and how she's been like that since she was a child. And Regina is dictatorial. She says, you can only wear pink on Wednesdays. You can only wear jeans once a week. You may never wear tracksuits, or you can't sit with us.
She's a controller.
Completely a controller. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I suppose I'm not allowed to know. I've got to see either the original, probably the original, or this. Does she come to a bad end? You probably can't tell me.
I can tell she gets hit by a bus and dies. No, she doesn't, but it's a joke in the film that she gets hit by a bus and dies. A sort of small, odd, alarming part of Mean Girls is how fast their yellow school buses drive.
Yes, it really happens quite a lot.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of things to watch out for in it. But okay. Lamorna, thank you so much for braving the Mean Girls with us today.
Thank you. It's been an education for those of us of my generation raised on, you know, the Breakfast Club and that kind of thing. This is an education. I shall immediately scamper off to the local multiplex.
Okay, watch out, because next week Alex might be sounding very different.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Exactly. Don't turn up in pink, Lucy.
Thank you so much, Lamorna.
Thank you.
Still to come on the show, Eric Naiman wonders why all of a sudden student essays mysteriously sound the same.
And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark. Now, Eric Naiman has taught at the University of California, Berkeley, for 30 years, but it was only recently that he began to notice certain recurrent words and themes in a group of student essays on Dostoevsky. Why, he wondered, were they also interested in the way that the Brothers Karamazov delved into various themes? Why was everything intricate, complex and multifaceted? The answer was ChatGPT. And it set Naiman to thinking what AI meant for the way that a generation of students is beginning to think and to write about literature. The result is a fascinating essay in this week's TLS, and we're delighted that he joins us now to tell us more. Thank you so much for joining us from sunny California.
Not so sunny at the moment, but thank you very much.
Okay, it might be slightly worse on this side of the Atlantic, I have to say, as we're bracing for Storm Jocelyn, aren't we, Lucy?
Yes, it's just a succession of storms here, and we like to imagine that it's always sunny in California.
Yes, I have imagined that you've plucked an orange from the tree just before you spoke to us. Now, that's all beside the point. I wondered if you could take us back to, as it were, your sort of moment of revelation, because I'm kind of picturing you marking these essays, reading through them, trying to get to grips with the students' minds and their intentions. Did you begin to realise that there was a kind of sameness about them? And were you bewildered at first?
I was initially somewhat grateful for the quality of the grammar in the essays. I generally read these papers closely and do kind of line-by-line edits, hoping that will improve the students' writing. And so I was noticing I was having to do that much less, which was very nice. But then there was this there were two things. There was the repetition of certain vocabulary items, and there was a sameness in the construction of the essays. And usually I give students a single word as a prompt because I like to be surprised by what they write about. And so, you know, it'll be a word like time or masculinity or some kind of concept. And I've got very interesting, and they can come up with their own if they want, but I've gotten very interesting essays in the past. And it's always nice to learn something from your students. And this time the papers, I noticed that a lot of them, first of all, took a concept and just applied it cookie cutter like to one character after another without any elaboration of an argument or escalation of a theme. And then at the end would say it's complicated, basically. And the other thing that they would do is repeat the central word of the essay, the concept, like masculinity, let's say, right? Again and again and again, but it could be replaced by almost any other word, and it would make just as much sense in the essay. So the grammatical quality of these essays was better, but the thinking behind it was largely absent. There was kind of no individual engagement with the text. And I think you could tell from that essay that I wrote it in a moment of sort of rage about.
You did seem quite cross.
Yeah, that did. I must say that I actually wondered if you had written the essay partly to demonstrate or to reassure perhaps the editors at the TLS that this was not written by ChatGPT or any large language model, because it is a very individual essay. It goes to a place that we'll come on to in a while that I certainly wasn't expecting it to go to. But you do start with this idea of what I suppose is a kind of surface competence that you saw. You weren't having to intervene so much with your red pen, but then you realized that there was this kind of sameness between them, and sameness indeed within them. You say that it's not just the vocabulary, it's the structure. Things become more like a list and they become banal, essentially.
Yeah, there's really a kind of lack of interest that you can tell on the part of the writer. And that kind of produces a lack of interest in the reader, me, because they're kind of easy to skim through. And I wasn't seeing students really engage with these complicated literary texts that have all these issues that in the past have, you know, I mean, a lot of students sign up for Dostoevsky courses because he engages them in so many ways. Getting back to your point about the essay not being written by ChatGPT itself, that came to me a little bit later, and I went back through the essay and took out anything that seemed like a cliche, which I guess one should always do, but here I was particularly aware of it. And I just think that one of the things that I like about writing for the TLS is that they respect their author's voice. You know, I've never had a sense with any review that I've done that there was a house style that the editors were trying to fit me into. And so they let me go wild, I guess.
Well, also, Alex, can I say, we would never assume that any of our contributors had written anything with ChatGPT.
No, of course not.
It's fascinating to me, Eric, that you could see it so clearly. I heard something on the news just today about deepfake videos, because they're beginning to be used in the elections. They're circulating, you know, videos and audio of political candidates saying something that they haven't said. And they got on a sort of technological guy who said, actually, if a human sits down in front of them, you can tell, which sounded very much like what you were saying. If you know, you're the person, you almost uniquely qualified to look at these things and go, no, that's not a proper engagement with Dostoevsky. That one is. So they're very good, but they're not flawless, are they?
No, and I think there's, you know, if you're reading literature, one of the things you're teaching your students to do is to be a close reader. And that's still important. And so, you know, as a teacher, as a professor, you become a close reader too. And it's not that hard. I think I would have harder, you know, I'm not trained to read images, right? So I might have a harder time there. I read this piece recently in the TLS's competitor, the New York Review of Books. Hope it's okay that I mentioned them.
That's fine. We very much respect them.
Jessica Riskin, who's a historian of science at Stanford. And it was about Alan Turing and kind of the move, the development from Turing to AI today. She wrote it last summer. And she talks about the Turing test, which was Turing imagined, you know, that you would have these walls up in front of a computer and a person. And artificial intelligence would pass the test when an average human being, whatever that is, if that person exists, couldn't tell the difference between them. And it struck me reading that the assumption that Turing and that maybe all AI people had made since then was that this test would be passed when AI improved itself to the level of the, you know, average human being. But what's happening is that AI may pass this test by bringing the level of human expression, right? By bringing the level of the average person's writing down to that of a computer. It's kind of like flattening the field. It's kind of like if you remember who Tonya Harding was.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, it's the Tonya Harding approach to writing.
Nobble the humans by making them write like you, and then they can't tell.
Gosh, that's it. So, in fact, it may be, as you said, that some of your students, and we should say it was a minority of your class, but nonetheless quite significant. It was 8 out of 36 essays. You know, so it's quite significant. And it might be that in the future you will read essays by students who haven't, you know, cheated, as it were, but it seems like they do. They might as well have done, because the language will have just come to take on this strange kind of AI-inflected sheen.
Yes, I think that's a really big problem. I just read that Arizona State University has signed a contract with OpenAI to provide ChatGPT, you know, the advanced model to all its faculty and students, and they're going to incorporate it in their freshman writing classes. So this is, if I were hiring someone for any kind of job involving communication, original thought, approach to policy that might not be standard, I would think hard about, you know, hiring someone from Arizona State after four or five years of this. And I think that's going to be a big problem. The other thing that really upset me, I didn't go into the personal cases in the article, but I did meet with nearly all the students who use ChatGPT, and they almost all admitted it right away. And they all knew that they shouldn't do it, but it was kind of so easy, right? It was already there on their desktop. They're under a lot of pressure. I think the strain, mental health strain on our students, particularly after the pandemic, and maybe given what's going on in politics around the world and in the US as well, is acute. But the thing that was really disheartening was that a couple of the students I didn't know very well, and they hadn't spoken in class and had not really been that engaged. Some of the students had been really involved and had been, I know they'd been reading the text. They said very valuable things in class discussion. And it struck me that if students like this, you know, highly functioning students who wrote better papers on their first paper on crime and punishment and did not use ChatGPT, if they were doing this, there's a major problem here.
And I guess at that moment, because they have a teacher like you, and you sound utterly committed to helping them and to working with them, then you can do a kind of course correction. You can say, look, this is better when you do it on your own. And hopefully they will go away and think, okay, right, I was feeling anxious and I used something, I shouldn't have done it, and I'm going to I won't do it. It's a wake-up call, I suppose. I guess the question is, when that doesn't happen in the, you know, when it becomes more widespread, that's an alarming thing for all teachers everywhere.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. You know, is it a wake-up call or not? This was on at the end of the semester. So, you know, I'm not going to probably see them in my classes again. are they going to do it in another class? If it's a bigger class where the professor is not looking at every paper. So I have a grad student who reads half the papers and I read half, and then I go over the ones that he has looked at. But in a bigger class, professor can't really do that. Are they going to get caught? Probably not. And I think getting caught is the wrong way to think about it, right? It's, you know, are they going to learn something from this? Mm. Are they going to try and write differently in the future? I don't know. Mm.
It's very interesting, again, that there was a wonderful line. You said that you like to surprise your students, but there's almost an aside about one of your students who said to you that he reads plot summaries of novels before, not instead of reading the texts, but before the texts themselves, because he doesn't like to be surprised. And I thought, gosh, fiction, why would you read something and not want to be surprised? And I know we all sometimes gravitate towards things that we like, you know, in moments when we're feeling a little bit more like consolation than challenge. But nonetheless, I mean, unsurprising fiction sounds like the worst kind of fiction.
Vladimir Nabokov, whom I work on a lot, you know, famously has said, you can't read a novel, you can only reread it. So you're trying to, you know, overcome the temporality of the experience of reading the novel and see it all before you at once, which is kind of utopian vision. But even he didn't say, you shouldn't read it the first time.
Don't worry.
You shouldn't.
There are people who really do go to the last page. I mean, serious readers who do go to the last page, which, again, I find extraordinary. But, you know, people, as long as they read properly.
We were talking earlier, Lucy, about how, you know, when you reread something over years, over many years, perhaps we were talking about Middlemarch, how your entire view of various characters, your relationship with particular characters changes at different points of your life, i.e. you get a bit more interested in the middle-aged ones when you're middle-aged, for example. So, you know, in other words, great works of literature and art in general are dynamic. We hope to have dynamic relationships with them. So if you start off just by reading the summary, that seems to be rather hampering yourself from the get-go.
That's a great point. And you know, that's true of something like Anna Karenina. It's definitely true of Proust, my God. And even with Tolstoy, you know, Tolstoy took so long to write some of these things that he changed his mind as he wrote. So I have a colleague, David Herman, at the University of Virginia, who's, you know, pointed out to me, you know, when you go back to the first part of Anna Karenina, you know, you're seeing a different Anna, not just because you're different, but because Tolstoy was different by the time he finished the novel. So
I was fascinated to read as well when you talk about how your university has talked about AI itself. I mean, like you were saying with Arizona State University, it's not being just talked about. I mean, obviously everyone says, oh no, students shouldn't use it to write their essays, but it's also for faculty members, isn't it, apparently, to use. And this wonderful thing you say, where there's an AI at the beginning, which stands for academic integrity. And then after that, the only AI in town is artificial intelligence and what use we can make of it.
It was the title of the memo was academic integrity. And then the phrase academic integrity appeared nowhere in the memo.
How did they want you to use it? I mean, without revealing any.
No, I think, first of all, I know from colleagues who have been to various kind of writers' conventions and teachers' conventions that AI is being marketed to high school teachers, in particular, for their grading. You know, so I think the phrase is, so you can do what's really important and teach, right? So they really want to get faculty, or this is OpenAI, so ChatGPT, want faculty to be using these tools in things like syllabus design, right? But then all your courses are going to be the same. And the university, I think this is the problem with the kind of skew away from the humanities in large universities, is they're aware that there's a problem in the humanities with ChatGPT, that it's going to be detrimental to the teaching of writing and expressing and kind of formulating an argument. But they know how interested people are in computer sciences, in business, right? And so they don't want to take a position that is going to alienate those people. It seems like Arizona State, you know, we'll see what they do, but that they've, you know, completely, from my point of view, it seems like they're sacrificing the humanities to computer science and to applications of ChatGPT. And so I think one of the things that faculty are in the humanities are upset about is the university has been largely absent in terms of sketching out a policy position on AI. And that's left faculty floundering. I don't know, you know, we wouldn't want them to tell us, oh, it's okay if students use AI, right? Because that's the basically the end of teaching composition in a way that's conducive to learning how to express yourself in an interesting way.
Well, and they mentioned previously that, you know, you go in very unexpected and non-ChatGPT predictable directions. And suddenly, in your essay, and to great effect, we're talking about Dostoevsky and Christ and the Inquisitor. And I'm going to ask you to talk us through that.
I worried a little bit about this because, in a way, the Grand Inquisitor is overwritten about as a topic in, you know, in Dostoevsky studies, right? D.H. Lawrence famously misunderstood it because he read only the Grand Legend of the Grand Inquisitor in a separate brochure, right? So, but basically, it's one of the brothers, Ivan, is telling his younger brother, Alyosha, who is extremely religious, he's telling him this story that he's invented, the Legend of the Grand Inquisitor. And basically, the story is that Christ shows up in Spain, in Seville, in the middle of the Inquisition, and he's immediately arrested by the cardinal in charge of the Inquisition. And although Christ says nothing, the cardinal berates him for making belief too difficult, for giving people the freedom to choose rather than making choices for them. And he goes on to say that you, Jesus, did not understand that people are weak, that it's only a select few who can follow you, and that they've brought their freedom to us and laid it at our feet, basically, and said, think for us, give us chains so that we can survive. And, you know, he goes back to, I guess, it's Matthew and Luke, and the notion of the temptation of Christ in the wilderness. And Ivan says, or his cardinal says, you know, you were offered the tools of miracle, mystery, and authority as a way of getting people almost unthinkingly to follow you. And you, Jesus, turned these, I sound like I'm preaching, I'm not even religious myself, you know. So you, Jesus, spurned these tools and left man in the difficult position of having to decide him or herself what to do with his freedom. I was thinking about, you know, we had spent 2 days on the Legend of the Grand Inquisitor, and we had talked it through and talked about the style of the presentation. I'd read them the biblical passages, and then suddenly they were using ChatGPT to write essays on the Brothers Karamazov. And this was somewhere in the back of my mind. It didn't really come to consciousness for a little bit. I was asking myself, why am I getting so upset? Is it just the ChatGPT? And then I realized, no, it's that they used it to write about this novel.
Yeah.
And that ChatGPT really is about miracle, mystery, and authority. You know, you type, you say, write me a paper about time in the Brothers Karamazov. And then it just, you know, spits it out line by line, grammatically perfect. You have no idea where it comes from. It seems totally right. You know, there's nothing particularly wrong in it usually. People are worried about, you know, the spread of fake information through AI, and guess that's a problem, but that wasn't a problem here. It's more saying nothing and a flattening of affect and giving up your freedom. You know, if you're taking a course on Dostoevsky, one of the great things is being able to ask yourself, does this text speak to me? You know, how do I resolve this problem? How does Dostoevsky express himself? How does he set up a scene, an argument? And all of these things, the students are just giving up that opportunity by using ChatGPT. So I think if it had been any other novel, I also would have been upset, but this was particularly distressing.
Yes, exactly. It's in the most fundamental way. They haven't got the point of Dostoevsky.
Maybe they have, but it's the kind of, is it that it's the abdication of like individual responsibility?
Okay, this is a great point, which I should have made in the essay. If a student had said, like had written an essay with ChatGPT and then brought that to the forefront and said, you know, I agree with the Grand Inquisitor. And that's why I've written my essay this way. But they didn't do that. You know, I mean, that would have been a really interesting kind of conceptual somersault to take at the end of the essay. But none of them did that. And so it was less a considered engagement with the argument of the Grand Inquisitor than a just lazy response to the text. And one that basically said to me, I read this, but, you know, it didn't get to me. And so, you know, part of it was my response to this, and I'm still thinking this through, is, you know, what do I do next time, right? Obviously, on some level, I did not teach this novel well enough if a quarter of the class could do this. So, you know, I think people talk about bringing ChatGPT into the classroom, but that by that they mean, you know, using it to help students write their essays. I'm going to bring it into the classroom as a topic and explicitly foreground it the next time I teach this novel. I need to give myself a rest of a couple of years, I think, for this.
Yeah, I think you do. I mean, look, that sounds like a brilliant response, a brilliantly creative response. But I think Lucy and I, we are here to tell you that you must not blame yourself for this. It's not, I don't think it's to do with your qualities of teacher. And now
not
listen,
the students either, because as you said, they'll be under all sorts of pressures. It's a very, very difficult situation. You know, basically there's a thing that says, are you feeling stressed? Are you run out of time? Are you worried about this? You can press this button and that bit's done. I mean,
it's something that as a reviewer myself, I can't promise I wouldn't ever do it.
Don't,
mainly
don't
because
tell me,
I wouldn't want to get promise. Found out. No, but, you know, I get, I'm now going to be very anxious if I ever find myself delving into anything in a review.
Yes,
I'm
that
going
is
to delve or write about existential crises, because that seems to come up over and over again too. Listen, Eric, I'm sorry we've run out of time, because this is so fascinating. I could talk to you about it for ages. We will direct readers to read this wonderful essay. It really made me think about things in a kind of scary way. But we wish you the very best of luck in dealing with your generations of students. And thank you so much for talking to us about it. It was wonderful.
Thank you both. This was a lot of fun. Thanks.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Lamorna Ash and Eric Naiman.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Charlotte Pardee.
We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, Alex Clark, goodbye.